The Public Relations Society of America's 2001 International Conference presents this live presentation recorded for PRSA in Atlanta, Georgia in October of 2001. If you're listening to the audio tape format, at the end of side one, please stop the tape and turn to side two for the conclusion of this presentation.
PRSA is recording this, which means a couple things. One, if you want to get a tape of this, if there's something here that you want, you're able to do that. If by any chance we stumble and say something funny, you can laugh out loud and it'll sound good on the tape, you know, but don't put any pressure on the audience. What we'll do is I'll introduce myself, and then Al, who's going to take the second half of the program, will give a little more full introduction of himself as we start. My name is Pat McGee. I'm an APR fellow with PRSA. And since the program book was printed, I've had a change myself. I'm listed as McGee Consulting Group in there. Now I'm a senior counsel and CEO with Jackson Jackson Wagner in New Hampshire. So I've had a little change myself since then. I'll give you a brief background on that so you know who's presenting to you today. Jackson Jackson Wagner is a behavioral public relations and management consulting firm. We have a national client base. We work out of New Hampshire, but we serve clients around the country. We take a behavioral approach simply because we know and our clients know that simply creating awareness anymore just doesn't cut it. Our clients don't stand for it, and we don't either. We know that we have to make real behavior change and measurable results, and that's what counts in public relations. And we approach it collaboratively, working with our clients. We have counselors who average about 15 years of experience. Most of them are accredited our fellows. And we work in a variety of areas, including strategic planning and implementation, organizational change and development, issue anticipation, crisis avoidance, and crisis containment, and behaviorally focused research. Now myself, I have about 25 years plus experience in public relations and consulting, working with clients from Fortune 500, Fortune 10 companies to local nonprofits. So we range a wide scale there. Al Schweitzer, who's my co-presenter today, is with Bell South. And I said Al will give you a much fuller introduction of himself when he gets up for his part of the presentation. So I want to set a couple expectations today. I've been on this side of the audience and your side as well. So I try to tell you what we're going to cover. If that's not what you want to hear, we won't be insulted if you go and find another one that you'd like to hear better. But I guarantee you, you're going to get something out of here that you can use. That's our goal today. We're going to talk a little bit about organizational change and the culture for organizations. Why we'll take a little bit of the theory and then walk you through a couple models that we think work pretty well in helping organizations assess where they are in their readiness for change, as well as a model we've been developing over the last few years on how you can help your organizations affect some change. And then after that, Al is going to present a case from Bell South on applying and showing you how he worked with his organization and going through a series of a rather large internal change in his organization that affected many employees and departments, and what they were able to do and some of the techniques and tactics he was able to use to affect that change. And after that, we'll close up. We'll take questions and answers for the remaining time. As you know, we have an hour and 15 minutes for this, and we're really held to keep that on time. You have other commitments. We have other commitments. So we'll wrap it up on the appointed hour. Also, there's the green evaluation forms. We encourage you to do that before you leave. It helps us. It helps PRSA to judge what they want to do in the future. And as all of us know in public relations, there's the tried and true race formula. We start with research, and we end with evaluation. So I started with evaluation. We're going to end with research. Let's do a quick survey in here, just so we know who our audience is. How many people are with corporations, for-profit corporations? It's like about half nonprofit corporations, colleges, universities, hospitals, all that sort of stuff. Okay. Associations, counseling firms, independent counselors, and students. I have a friend here who's a student, so we have a student with us as well. All right, great. So most of you are from organizations, for-profit, and then the rest split out among that. So let's talk a little bit about change and what change is all about and how it affects our organizations. And I think that certainly our second speaker today couldn't have set this presentation up any better, talking about some of the things that are going on in our world. And what we know about that and what we know about change that's occurring in our world obviously affects our own organizations. And I don't think we have to look any further than back in time than September 11th to see what effect events have on our organizations. And I think you'll hear this a lot, and you probably should at this conference this week, that most of us obviously were preparing to talk about certain things before September 11th. But after September 11th, things have changed in a great way. And as public relations practitioners, I think it's time for us to say, how can we help our organizations cope with some of the events that have gone on? Because they affect us. And how do they affect us? Because we know that the basis for what we do is maintaining mutually positive relationships with those publics who are critical to our success. And the basis of those relationships is trust. And now we have an atmosphere in our country that's almost of mistrust in many ways. And we look at what some of our organizations are doing, and here's where we have to come to the forefront and be the counselors to our organizations. What's happening in some of our organizations? Well, first of all, our visitor centers are closed. Secondly, we're limiting access to our institutions. We're keeping people out. Third, we're restricting the flow of information. We can't tell you as much about ourselves as we did before. Fourth, we've got web pages that have come down in part or in their entirety. Fifth, we have new email protocols. In many companies, you can't open an email now that has an attachment on it. Just can't open it. Fifth, we've got new protocols for handling the regular mail. If something looks suspicious, a little odd shaped, maybe doesn't have a return address on it, we don't know who the sender is, it gets discarded. And finally, we have some of our organizations who are really prohibiting their senior management from going out into certain public forums. So many of the traditional things that we would say would be good ways to build and maintain relationships with our critical publics are now taken away, and we're building up barriers. So it's our job as PR practitioners to offer strategic insight into our organizations and with our clients on how to build trust, maintain trust, and build relationships in this time. So in this atmosphere of mistrust and a really reality-altering change after September 11th, we now say, with all that in mind, how do we help our organizations move forward and change? So let's take a little bit of a look at some background I think will help us. First of all, I want to provide a little, what we would call a sampler of why organizations resist change. And this is a sampler simply because I couldn't possibly list all the reasons why organizations resist change. You mentally will be adding many more points to this than I will. But let's just talk about some key ones that we see all the time. First of all, you have to give up the change means you give up the status quo. It means who I am today is going to be different if we change. What I do is going to be different. I think our speaker said it best, change is great. That means you're going to change, I'm not. And that's true. That's what we say. Okay, yeah, we can change it. Change Harry's department. That's fine. But don't change mine. I don't want to change. So we have to give up a status quo that we've become comfortable with. Even if we don't like it, we know it. We're comfortable with it. So one of the points of resistance always in an organization is giving up the status quo. Secondly, change is a process where we have to give something to get something. We're not just adding all the time. Change means that there's an exchange going on. We're giving up something. We used to do it this way, and now we're going to do it that way. I used to have this form in front of me. Now I don't. I have to do it this way. I used to be able to go and talk to this person, but now they're moved. I have to do something else. So it's giving up something, and something we might like or that our fellow employees might like. Gee, I really love that. You know, when I got that newsletter in the morning, I really liked that, but now it's gone. I had to give up something. Now it's all electronic mail. I don't have a print form anymore. So there's resistance to giving up something that you like. Here's one that I think we've seen. Past history of failed change causes resistance to further change. What do we hear? Yeah, we tried that before. That didn't work. Never going to do that again. Oh, yeah, we tried that last year. We had someone else come in and tell us about that. That didn't work. We have all these histories in our organizations where we tried to change, but there was failure, or it wasn't successful, or it didn't come out the way we wanted. So that builds up resistance. We have a whole other presentation we go into. Part of the thing we call about, remember mad cow disease, we call this mad change disease, where you get inoculated to all the changes in the organization. So what happens to many people? They just duck down, they say, look it, this will pass, okay? Just keep your heads down, don't worry about it. It's the fad of the day, the program of the hour, the change du jour, we'll get through it, don't worry about it. And that gets into an organization because we've had these failures before. Doesn't mean that there wasn't a right thing. Maybe it was poorly executed, it was poorly thought out, maybe the timing was wrong, but we have this history in our organizations of failed changes, which makes us resistant to new ones. And finally, and you'll say this along with me, how many times have we heard that? That's the way we've always done it. Well, son, you know, that's the way we've always done it around here. Do you think there was anyone at Polaroid saying, well, that's the way we've always done it around here? I bet there were a lot of people saying that's the way we've always done it around here. And our speaker said maybe they couldn't change. Maybe they just couldn't bring themselves about to change who they were as an essential part of their business. But how many times, if you've talked to someone, and we know that you're in the middle of all this change in your organizations, the first response is, that's the way we've always done it. What difference does it make if that's the way you've always done it? Are we wearing the same clothes we wore 20 years ago? Do we look the same way we did 20 years ago? Do we think the same way? Do we use the same office equipment, the same computers? Do we drive the same car? No, but that's the way we always done it. So our organizations get locked into this mindset of that's the way we always done it. So we get resistance. And if we have resistance, how does that manifest itself in the organization? What do we see happening in our organizations when we have resistance? Again, just a sample. There's many other ways. First of all, we have top-down resistance. Call it the old boy network, call it whatever you want. People at the top don't want to change. Now, there might be a lot of people down lower in the organization saying, hey, this is crazy, we got to do something. And it gets up to the top and says, nope, that's the way we always done it, we're not going to change, this is where we are, look at it, we've been successful this far, we're not going to do anything else. Resistance comes from there, and it manifests itself in that top-down approach to saying no change. Or we have just the opposite. How many have been involved in a situation where maybe a new CEO come in, a new manager, a new supervisor, a new executive vice president who says, boy, are we going to do something here? We're going to change this. You're going to love it. We're going to throw all that out. We're going to bring all this in. And what are the employees saying? No way, baby. So sometimes with the resistance that manifests itself up from the lower levels of the organization. What else do we see? How does this manifest itself, this resistance to change? We see it in confrontation. Now, confrontation takes many forms in an organization. It can be personal, one-on-one confrontation. I don't like you, therefore I'm not going to do what you ask. It can be taken to the ultimate scale where we have strikes and slowdowns and job actions. But this confrontation usually is around some point of change. The organization or some group wants to do something, another group doesn't want to do it, and we have this confrontation. So we see this come up again and again. And sometimes it's just in your own work group, this confrontation. And finally, we have sabotage as a way that the resistance is manifested in an organization. How does sabotage work? Well, the new procedure is that you've got to have this email into us with your expenses, and Al will touch on a lot of detail, and in 2 days. Oh, yeah? I'm going to have it in 4 days. I'm not complying with that. I'm going to sabotage that process. And it takes it from that stage all the way up to actual sabotage, where people who don't like what's going on in the organization actually sabotage either some of the mechanical operations or some of the real operations. We see outside people don't like what you're doing, can sabotage what you're doing. That takes the form of protest. That takes the form of actual physical incursions into your property and so forth. So we see that, and there's many other ways, but we see these are many the most common ways that we see in working with clients how this resistance to organization manifests itself. And we're going to talk about how to deal with that in a little bit. So, if we know where some of the resistance comes from and how it manifests itself, what's the big so what? Why should I care? I'm in public relations, you know? Well, we are, almost by definition, the agents of change for our organization. And we're going to talk just a little bit about this. And why are we the agents of change in our organizations? Why are we, as public relations practitioners, the ones that our organization should be turning to, or we should be turning to them and saying, hey, look at something's going on? First of all, who else has as wide a view of things as we do in public relations? Who looks out over the whole organization and says, we don't see silos as many people do. We see the whole organization. So we have a wide view. Who else is actually charged with taking the pulse of what's going on inside the company and outside the company? Are your managers or your clients turning to you and saying, I don't understand that. What's going on? Why are people acting that way? You're supposed to know, because we are agents of change. Our definition, really, of who we are people who manage relationships. We understand that. That's why we're in this business. So if we're relationships managers, we should be the ones who are saying, hey, you know, I know there's some change, but if we could get this going, build a better relationship here, here's a problem over here, we can do this, we can offer advice, strategic advice on doing that. And finally, who has the communications theory, the training and the skills to be able to help our organizations communicate not only what, but why and how this change is occurring? And who has the understanding of the theory of behavioral public relations? And I'll put a plug in, if you don't believe me about that, we're doing a double session this afternoon with our firm on behavioral public relations and 6 applications of that. If you don't believe me, sit down on that. But who else knows about that what we really have to do is affect behavior change and we'll be successful than us? That's our training. That's where we come from. We know how to communicate. We understand people. So we're the agents of change. So we should be in the middle of any change process in the organization. So with that as a prelude to, I'm going to talk about 2 things for a few minutes. One is what we call 8 key areas for cultural change. And these, I believe these handouts are in the electronic conference packet that you get that we used to have a big book that we used to hand out. We changed. We don't do that anymore, so you don't have them with you when you're sitting here, but I believe that's available after the conference. You can download some of those. So those are there. I also have, which we didn't have time to go into, but we have something called an actionable corporate culture that has takes you through 8 steps. For example, to what extent are mission, vision, values alive and lived? So just taking encouraged or discouraged and so forth. We have that. That won't be on the web. If you'd like a copy of actionable corporate culture, write that on a business card, give it to me afterwards, and we'll send it to you. We just couldn't work it into the presentation today. So let's talk about some culture change in the 8 key areas that we talk about. First of all, if we want to change our culture, what's the first thing we have to do? We have to identify what that is, okay? We have to identify what culture we want and what culture we have, and then we know what we're going to change. So first process is to identify that. And secondly, we want to set up not only where we are, where we're going to, and that gives us some roadmaps. And I think walking through this process will help us see that. So working with the culture varies depending on the situation. Are we in a merger, or a demerger, or an acquisition? What's going on? Are we having some dissonance in the culture? One group thinks this way, one group thinks the other way, and the management says something else. Do we have that sort of dynamic going on? And not all these areas, these 8 areas, are critical for every situation. I think you'll find applications to most of you in them. So first of all, we have to look at employee behavior in our culture. We're really taking, if you want, a cultural audit of our organization. We do this a lot with clients. We do communications audits, and we go on and say, especially if you're thinking of doing a big change, let's take a little audit of where you are right now. And let's help you assess that. So we start with employee behavior. What employee behaviors are exhibited that mirror and or conflict with what management is expecting? So where are we right now? And then let's take an inventory of some of our current behaviors. Let's see what's happening now. Offer some bottom line evaluations that help a change program. And what we suggest here is sort of a mini gap study. You all know about gap studies. Gap studies is where, for example, an organization says, we want to be known for this. Okay, well, write down all the things you want to be known for. And we write them all down. We get management involved. These are all the things you want to be known for. Yep, is that it? That's it. Okay, let's go out and ask the community what you, or this is what we stand for. Let's ask the community what you're known for. So we have all these things that we wrote down. This is what we stand for. We stand for high customer service. We stand for personal response. We stand for this. We go and ask the community, what are they known for? Oh, man, don't call them. You know, you're on hold for 10 minutes. It's awful. So we have a gap study. And we know what we stand for, what we're known for, fill in the gaps. That's what we suggest with our employees. Let's take a little gap study of what behaviors we want, what behaviors we currently have. We'll know where to put our emphasis on getting the behaviors that are going to get us to this change. The second point is employee values and attitudes. And what do employees currently feel are the organization's values and attitudes? What are their personal beliefs, and how close or disparate are those from the organizational values and beliefs and attitudes? Because until we understand where the employees are in understanding what they're expressing, what they see as their values, it's going to be very hard for us to move them because we don't understand where they are. And this is a good thing. You can do a survey. You can survey your employees and find out, you know, you don't ask them what their values are. You ask them, what do you think about customer service? Or what do you think about the way our lobby looks? Or what do you think about this? So you get some good information. And another way to do this is just walk around. Open your eyes. Walk around your organization. You'll find out what people think are valuable just by what they put up. Is it an open organization? Do they have pictures of their families up there? Do they have little knickknacks that their kids gave them? Or is it sterile? You're going to find out pretty quickly just by looking what's on the walls, what kind of values and attitudes they have. Corporate policies. How do the current policies of the organization support or work against the desired culture? What should be changed, improved, or modified? In other words, policies must support what we're trying to do. And for a new culture, what we see is sometimes what policies we have are in direct conflict with this culture. For example, our culture, we want to have great loyalty among our employees because we want them to be ambassadors for us. We want them to go out and talk to the community. It's important for us for them to be out telling the community what we're doing because we're making this big change, and it's very important. So loyalty is great for us. Oh, by the way, we're laying off 25% of the people, okay? But we want you to be loyal, okay? So we have a little disconnect between values and what we're doing. So we have to align those before we really can move forward. So our corporate policies have to be in the process of, in our process of looking at our culture so that we align them with our expectation for the new culture. And the fourth point is organizational structure. Are there structural considerations that affect culture? If our structure contradicts that, change will not be achieved. For example, do we have open communications? Yes. Oh, yes. Our organization stands for open and frank communications. So you walk around, what do you see? All the executive doors are closed, right? Closed doors. Now, is that really good for open communications? Do you feel you can just walk in there and say, hey, Jane, I've got a problem. Can I talk to you about that? No, go see my secretary. Make an appointment, and maybe I'll see you next week. So we've got to align our structure with our culture. Another example would be, well, you know, here at ABC Company, we're pro-family. Wow, that's great. That makes me feel good. Now, you know, I'm a woman, and we're going to have a baby. What's your family leave policy? Oh, family leave policy? Well, you know, maybe the weekend that you're out with your baby, we'll give you a little time. And we've got to align our policies. We've got to align our structures to reflect what we want to happen in the culture, in the new culture. Four more that we're going to reach. Staffing and training. If we really want to make a cultural change, change the culture in our organization, we need to pay a lot of attention with this. Now, human resources are going to say, hey, we handle training in this organization, and we know how to do it. Fine. Just let us be present. Let's give you a few ideas on that. What preparations are managers given for understanding how and why the organization does things? What's the one thing that we've learned from decades of research on employee communication? Where is the number one place where employees want to get information concerning their job and their organization? Where is it? Immediate supervisor. It's not the email. It's not the newsletter. It's not the memo. It's the immediate supervisor. So we know that. We know that's where people want to get their information about their jobs. So we've got then to take our managers and our supervisors and train them on both the hows and the whys of what we're trying to do. You can only get so far in saying, this is the way it is, do it or leave. And again, is that really the type of culture we want? So we train our managers. And this process that we know works, we know it's proven valuable in organization after organization. We train them how to present the change, how to explain it, how to put, this is what we're doing it, this is why we're doing it. Because if we can get people to understand why, we're going to get their behavior a lot quicker. And as we say, osmosis does not work well with corporate culture. Well, you'll be around here long enough, you'll figure it out, okay? Because I really can't explain it, but just hang around here long enough and you'll figure it out. Just doesn't work. There's no way to treat employees either. Physical environment. Are the physical surroundings conducive to developing the desired culture? What kinds of quality or safety controls are in place? Do you think your employees today have a heightened concern about security and safety? Better believe it. Better believe it. If you're in any institution working like with a community group, YMCA or something, parents are dropping their kids off, do you think those parents have a few more concerns about what kind of security you have in your organization to protect their children? Better believe it. Are our physical surroundings giving the right message right now in terms of security and safety? We can all make, you know, there's a lot of, you know, black humor going on about what happened and all these, you will hear a lot of jokes. Just a way of expressing tension, but believe me, this is top of mind of people today. So our physical environment, you're all familiar with Maslow's theory, hierarchy of values and so forth, that the lower you are on the scale, and I think I have it, just if you don't, it's not Maslow, where is Maslow? There he is. We know what Maslow says, the lower are you on scale, the physiological needs, those are the things that drive us. Once we meet those, we're a little bit farther up. Safety is right there. So if people aren't feeling safe right now, are you going to get them to think about this big cultural change that you want to occur? No way, because they're down here. You want them up here on ego and respect or maybe even self-actualization. They're stuck down here. So we know that. I mean, this is not news. We know it. Let's just act on it. So physical environment is very important for cultural change. Symbolic, what do we mean by that? Well, simply, are there appropriate symbolic actions taking place to assure stability and pride in the organization? Is there something that we can see? It looks different. It feels different. Oh, this feels good. I like it. I can see it. Is anything of that going on? We've got to make the change obvious and evident to everyone that this is going on. Couple examples. Obviously, you can put signs and posters up. That's great. Good. We like to have good visual communication, and symbolic communication helps. We worked with a client that wanted to have to say that he was a new CEO, wanted to make sure that people understood that they could come in and talk to him anytime. What did he do? He went to his office and took the door off it, took the door off the hinges, got rid of it. Was that symbolic communication? How long do you think it took that to get around the organization? Hey, did you see what the new guy did? He took his door off. It took about maybe 2 minutes to get around the entire organization. Because you know the speed of light of your internal communication system, the informal one, the one that we don't have in the organizational chart. But if, you know, Harry and Sally had a date last night, how long that takes to get around. That's the system that we're talking about. Pretty fast. Another CEO came in, new organization, really wanted to get the employees to understand what he was trying to accomplish. Walked into the lobby, looked like crap. Just old stuff, old furniture. And he went up and his new administrative assistant said, "Well, Mr. President, tomorrow your new furniture is coming. Because, you know, you're a new CEO, we want you to have this new furniture." He said, "Okay." So what he did is when they bought the new furniture, he said, "No, that goes down in the lobby. Take the furniture in the lobby and put it in my office." Do you think that was symbolic in communications about a cultural change in that organization? Absolutely. Don't overlook the symbolic part of it. And finally, social influence, what we mean there. What's the status of the relationships with our key publics? We know that's critical around the organization. Because as we're going through change, what do you want your people to hear? "Hey, I like what you're doing. Gee, that's great. You guys are really changing. I didn't think you could do that. That's wonderful." All that positive reinforcement just helps your employees, as opposed to going out and say, you know, we've worked with clients that don't want to wear the caps or the t-shirts out in public. That's not what we want. We want people to say, "Good job." And how do we do that? Well, you know, we work through opinion leaders in those outside groups to help get that behavior. So those are eight considerations in a cultural change that may not all apply to your organizations, may not all apply to your situations, but I think you'll find a lot of those that you can use when you think about making a cultural change. And I got to wrap up because I got to leave time for the really important stuff of learning how this thing gets done. I just want to spend a couple minutes on a model that we've been developing the last few years that helps us manage change. This is based loosely on the Catherine Kubler-Ross seven stages of death, I think, or death and dying. But what we found working with organizations and change, that these are four steps that if we follow them, really help us get some change moving in our organization. The first one is anticipation. And here, we're really dealing with expectations. And the number one point here is we've got to set the expectations, or you know what? Other people set them for us and we can't meet them. So this is the stage where we're talking, you know, things might be changing around here. It's going to be okay. Might be a little difficult for 3 or 4 months, but we're going to come out of it. Start setting some expectations. And then now you're going to deal with some rumors. "Hey, I heard this. I heard this." No. Let me tell you what's going on. So we're dealing with expectations at this. We would like to make a preemptive announcement of what's going on and not let it break in the media or not let it break somewhere else, that we take charge of that. So this is that stage where it's a little uncomfortable, but we're really dealing with how to do that. We're saying, you know, there's going to be a change, and Rita and David, could you come? I'd like to get some opinions from you, okay? I'd like to run a few things by you. Get some input early on. Start building some support for your change. Then we have the announcement and the immediate aftermath. And what's really important? Who makes it? Where? How? Any symbolic communications involved in that? Where you stand? Where you make the announcement? The PRSA Foundation did a study that shows the announcer is as important as the announcement. So who's going to make the? Is it the CEO? Is that the right person to do it? Should it be someone else? Should it be a general manager? Should it be a line manager? Should it be a vice president? Should it be the chairman of the board? Who should it be? Think about that. And then we have some training before we get into the catharsis and mourning stage. We start some training with our managers around this. Hey, look, here's what you're going to deal with. We want you to know that. Here's how you can deal with it. We set up our 800 numbers, our hotlines, counseling, mentoring, whatever we have to do to support our people during the change, rumor control. And then these aren't neat little things. We draw lines. We kind of slop back and forth in these in any organization. But we have the stage which we call catharsis or mourning where, it's really bad. What we don't want to do is trash what went before us, okay? Because so many people have invested their lives in what went before us that we don't want to say, are you kidding? That was all a bunch of hooey. No, you say, yeah, I know. That's pretty bad. I feel sad. But, you know, we got to move on. We're moving on. We've got to move forward. Pretty bad. Yep, too bad. Let's go forward. So, the key to this is to have your management leading the mourning process, saying, the president saying, yeah, I know, a lot of you feel uncomfortable about what's going on. I feel a little, sad that we had to make these changes. We did have to lay off some people. People took early retirement. I feel bad about that, but you know what? We got to move on. You know why you need your management to do that? Because the management's going to say, morning's over, catharsis is over, let's get back to work. If they're not involved in that process, they're going to seem very cold and insensitive when it comes time to move on. Look for ways to have symbolic communication and action. And then finally, get on with it, returning to productivity, symbolic action. You know, let's take all those old letterheads down. We're going to have a big fire outside. We'll have a little party afterwards. We've got our new logo now, our new stationery. Let's get rid of the stuff before it's gone. Don't want to use it anymore. We're going to be a better organization, a stronger organization. We sensitize our culture inside to the whys and then the hows. Why, how, and do that as quickly as possible. And then, you know, be realistic. Set up survivor groups. Call them whatever you want. You know, set up ways for people to still express some, but have good opinion leaders, have role models, great place for role models in your organization to say, hey, you know, I went through this change too. I'm moving on. You want to talk to me about it, fine, but I'm moving on. Get some role models out there early. We found that following this model really does help an organization and you to cope with change. So I'm going to break now. I'm going to ask Al to come up, and then I hope we'll have some time for some questions. And Al's going to walk you, well, he'll tell you what, he's been involved in a real interesting case at Bell South. So let me switch the microphone over here.
Everybody here? My name is Al Schweitzer, and I work at Bell South Corporation, worked there for almost 7 years. Very briefly, my background, I was a newspaper man for 10 years, and as you know, that's kind of a shrinking industry, and as luck have it, I ended up with a bank where they wanted, since I was out of work, and they needed somebody to write up some profiles on their directors, and which actually was investment like the investor relations, and discovered, gee, this is what makes America tick, business. And ever since then, I've been pretty excited about working in the business area. Worked in St. Louis at Fleshman Hillard for a few years on issues management, and then my wife was offered a tenure track position at Agnes Scott College, a women's college in Decatur, Georgia. And so, and when I came to well, not too long after I came to Atlanta, then I was offered a position at Bell South. And what's interesting, and really my story is kind of a personal story in a way, because just because of my background, I was in the media relations, external relations part. But then this was about 3 years ago, since I could, one of my specialties was the financial media and Wall Street media, and I got to know the finance people in our organization. And they came up with a finance project that was internal. And for me, that was a big change. And and that's really, we're getting into the example, the case study, because to me, when I first started on the project, it was, I was put on a design team. And at first I thought, well, all they need is just somebody to write like a newsletter or something. It's, what's the big deal? And they said, well, you learn about change management. They'd never even heard of the term. And but in the course of my presentation here, whoops, you'll see that. Let me get everything on here. I was in a situation where we all talk about having a seat at the table, where as the group was starting out, And I really was, I was the only communications person. So it was like I had to really do an examination of who I was and what I was supposed to do for this organization. And here's what the whole thing was about. And this has happened with several companies. I think Bell South was one of the first, but certainly was not the first. And the idea was to create a shared services center. This is known as, and if you don't know what that is, very simply, it's a back office operations. Things like payroll, accounts payable, general ledger, things which a customer or to the public they will never see. But without those things, you can't have a business because you have to develop people for, have to pay people, and the bills have to be paid. And it's a very critical part of a company, and particularly a large company where it's a company like Bell South, where actually parts of Bell South, just like the telephone industry, are 100 years old. And at the same time, you have new technologies developing, like wireless, the internet, data. Like, you know, most of the traffic now over telephone lines is no longer voice, but data. You had a mixture of subsidiaries that had some very progressive best practice kind of operations, and then you had other companies which were maybe startup that were just creating things. So there was a lot of time and energy spent in developing those, and as a result, you could understand it was just cost higher. So the idea, they did a benchmarking study, a feasibility study, and using consultants, and there was a series of consultants used on it. From like PricewaterhouseCoopers, Arthur Anderson, doing very parts of the business, where they came up with the proposal that they could save, and I don't hold me to this figure, but let's say $18 million a year, where they could save money. So you know, it looks pretty interesting. Even with a certain net investment in the front end, that over after 2 years, they could save $18 million a year. So this was, obviously, it got the buy-in of the board of directors, the CEO, and it was just like a no-brainer. But the thing was, it meant that there's going to have to be a change. And the change was that we're going to have to create a new company, a shared service company, but it was incorporated, that would be roughly about 700 employees, and it would be based, though, on current employees. In, let's say, there's a dozen to 20 subsidiaries of Bell South. And I say there's a span there because it depends on if they're international, because they're parts of the company that may or may not get involved. So that's a pretty big change, because it means that, first of all, there's going to be a physical change. The employees, from the beginning, they said that in principle there will be no involuntary separations. So there's a certain ease there, that people were not going to be pushed out of jobs. However, they may work on another part of town. In some cases, they would work in a different city. Well, as you know, I mean, if you're used to sending your children to a certain school and a certain daycare and things like that, it gets very personal. And matter of fact, one of the most intense discussions, which really was a surprise to a lot of us, was parking. You know, where they're going to park their car. If they were getting free parking, they might end up in working downtown Atlanta, where they'd have to spend $75 a month, and that would be even after a company subsidy. So that was it got down to the nitty gritty, is what it amounts to. And there was since this was a we're trying to be real smart about this. As I said, we got, as we consider the top consultants of actually how to do the business, we thought that the best way to do this, and I mentioned the various processes, there was like nine of them. I mentioned accounts payable, payroll, time and attendance. We split them into roughly the employee-focused ones, would be like with HR, like the payroll, employee reimbursement for their expenses, and then the purely financial things like the general ledger or something that's called the project accounting, which means that whenever you start a new venture or some new activity, there's a ramp up for that. Well, there's accounting. It was a very aggressive approach the Bell South had, but to create actually these 9 processes that would be representing the entire corporation. So that meant that the dozen or so companies would, representatives from them, for those companies, would get together in a period of 6 to 8 weeks, and they had these sessions where they would come to a resolution on, if we're going to be have one shared services center, and we're going to do, let's take the example of payroll, now how are we going to do that? And because you had a dozen different ways of doing it. And let's do it, and the guidelines were they wanted a best practice that they wanted to leverage over the entire company, and that they would, if it meant new processes, in other words, new IT, you know, rather costly investment, they would do that. But again, there was the cost factor. There were certain limitations because the whole idea was to save money. So that sent out the signal right away that this wasn't just something imposed on employees, that they really were giving everybody a voice in how this new center would be created. So when we talk about the term culture, this from the get-go was, we wanted that very much part of the cultural message, that whichever way your company is doing it, that's important to us to know how that is. And that the ending process would be a resolution or an agreement on trying to integrate as much as well, it'd be a certain way of doing things and for accounts payable and so on. From a communications point of view, the first kind of couple of months we were just kind of all ears. But what we did was myself on a communications team, it ended up calling it a communications change management. We interviewed the team leads of the 9 respective processes and developed the best we could, and although we knew that things would change, a communications plan that would be very specific to their needs. And without going into details, just could understand that for example, in a process that involved opening up literally tens of thousands of envelopes a day, like for example in the receipts where people pay their phone bill, they process in one center anywhere from $1.5 million to $2 million a day in checks, cash, whatever. Well, they don't recommend cash, but sometimes people do send in cash. And so this was a very specific team of maybe 100 people that would process. Whereas in some other, in developing the communication plans for others, maybe it was a company-wide, where like with employee reimbursement, where every employee, Bell South is a company of 100,000 employees, where the employees would have, that was the audience. So it wasn't just the focus of an internal group, the back office group, but it really was the audience was 100,000 employees. Now, just to give you an idea, I'm getting to the heart of the matter here is that I kind of resist just throwing out tactics, because this very much was a creative effort. In other words, we just didn't have a mindset that, oh, okay, your payroll, you know, this is what we're going to do for you. You know, it's going to be email, it's going to be a newsletter, a website. No, we'd had to try to be smart as possible, and where you really tap into the stakeholders of each group, each organization, to find out if we really want to make the behavioral change, like Pat was referring to, what is going to get their people's attention. And with one group, it may be something very different. We did a couple of things, though, which just to kind of really get everybody's attention in the beginning was we had our first announcement of this because, and we had to move quickly because when you create some activity, you have a design team set up to create a new company, there's rumors. Well, why are they doing that? You know, what's going to happen? Whose jobs are going to be impacted by that? So we wanted to get out as soon as possible just what was happening. So we did a video a 10-minute video, not a very long video, but describing the processes that we were going to create, what this company was supposed to do, the money, the purpose of it, saving money, as well as actually for employees, giving a so-called backroom employee that worked in payroll in the back room actually a strategic position in the company. And what I mean by that was that by creating a shared services center and taking these concerns away from the subsidiaries, actually what it did was, it was very strategic because it meant that they would, the subsidiaries themselves would then focus better on their customers. They didn't have to worry about paying bills. They didn't have to worry about payroll or general ledger or project accounting. They could focus on the things that they should be doing best. And not only showing what their position was, what their roles and responsibilities in this new view would be, but also offering them things in training that maybe they didn't get with their own company, because this was going to be a shared services center dedicated to another one of the things in our mission statement, and as far as the culture went, was a center of excellence. So that there would be a continuing enhancing the servicing of the clients, the customers in the company, so that the employee felt that they had a more important role than they had in the so-called back office of their subsidiary before. So we did things like an open house. That was another thing. When we finally picked and it was a period of it didn't happen as soon as we had hoped, but we did pick a permanent home for this shared service center. We had an open house, and actually it was just a couple blocks from here in downtown Atlanta, and it's an architectural gem. It was kind of interesting. It was one of these buildings built years ago when they thought that computer display centers were going to be the new thing. This is like in the 70s, and it just never panned out. But John Portman, who, as a matter of fact, is the architect who built this building and a lot of the buildings around here in what they call Peachtree Center, it was actually Class B space, so it was pretty cheap to come by in the real estate market. But Bell South, for so many million dollars, fixed it up into offices. And when when we had this open house, which everything wasn't done when we had the open house, but they just came in and they saw the atriums and the sound of the water and the elevators were different, and all of a sudden they were jazzed. They got excited to come in, even though that some of the floors were still concrete. But it was something that really paid off. So we just trying to be creative about anything we could do to inform employees about the company, what their role was, and then, of course, with the specific processes. That was part of the communications plans we had for specific activities. I've hinted to these earlier. One of the things is, I think it's been my experience that you can make a mistake, you've got all these great ideas, and then the employee might get the impression that you need to go in 17 directions at once. Well, if you go in 17 directions at once, you're not going to usually get very far. So we did focus on, these are three that even though, in our literature we talked about a lot of other things, but these, the easy to do business with, we wanted our customer, which you kind of see now that when I speak of a customer, that's really another Bell South department, or it's a Bell South subsidiary. But ultimately, though, we do have in mind the business customer outside of Bell South, the residential customer who has a dial-up service with the internet or the DSL broadband speed access to the internet. It's a service we call fast access. This is, you know, very much in mind, because that's the purpose of this. And then commitment to excellence. I've referenced that already. And then a great place to work. This was a it's always in Bell South, because we've had such a very successful period of ever since the breakup of AT&T. Bell South was the largest actually regional company, and it's in terms of its balance sheet and relationship with Wall Street has been the stock has done extremely well. We wanted to send the message that the employees should benefit and should enjoy that benefit of that enhancing of the company. So, and this is reflected in the kind of communications, open and honest communications in this whole process. There were things that, because we didn't know like what IT processes were going to be used, we had the policy that if we know what they are and when they're decided, we're going to give you all the information we have when we get it. But we also want you to know that we don't have the answers to everything, because this is the part of the design of creating the company was there are at certain stages, we call them milestones. And of course, this is all planned out actually a year and a half in advance once the basic design was created. And that when we reached a milestone, we would brief the employees through newsletters, websites, meetings with managers. Pat's already referred to that. There's no question about it. That I mentioned it was kind of a personal experience to me, because coming from the external media, where you call the media, you pitch the media, and you know, you sometimes you can do everything perfect, and you get zero results, and then another time you do everything wrong, and all of a sudden they want to give you a raise and give you a bonus, and so it's but with and what's the interesting part with the internal communications is that there is a little bit more control there, and what we found is that the first level supervisor is the person that the employees will really respond to, because in a small group, typically, you know, let's just say, you know, like a dozen people or so, an employee has the opportunity to express doubts, and it's a general "I'll level with you" kind of communication. And so this was very much part of the great place to work. The one thing, and again, it's and I go back to the experiential part, because I really, as I said, I was the person at the table, the only communications person, and I guess in the past several years, I was with other communications people that at least we could speak the same language, whereas suddenly I was at a table where they're talking about business, and they didn't care whether you said something or not. Of course, your job was that they wanted communications to go out and the employees to know it, but I had to figure out, you know, and these IT people are talking about the new process, because, you know, how is this going to impact an employee? Or let's say if they move all the payroll to, you know, the north side of town. I mean, these were the sort of things where they would talk about that as a matter of fact, where I would have to, you know, say, well, now what is this going to mean for me as a communicator and with the employees? How is it going to impact the employees? So the first thing, and again, this we learned, was that there's to focus very much on the stakeholders. And in an organization, what this means is that some people are more influential than others. Obviously, the CEO He's a stakeholder. We used the form of the cascading model, where if we were going to roll out a new process, it meant that if the CEO said it was okay, that was not adequate for us. We had to make sure that on every level down, and specifically on the process impacted, that the people that could stop us, we want to know who they were, and you know, could stop us. Now, this was a successful venture, but I take the negative part of that, because very often what happens is, and this is, I'm just giving another version of what Pat explained earlier, is that, for example, we would have very regular meetings with all the leadership folks of, this is what's going to happen, and this is what we're going to do. And of course, I mean, they were the participants. It's not like we were doing something to them, but just as this is how you can help us move along. And you go to these meetings, and people would nod their heads. Yeah, okay. Well, but we grew very skeptical after a while when it became the phase of the process where they would have to actually provide feedback on what we were doing, or maybe discuss some personnel changes. And then it was a question of, well, you're going to do what? And then we realized that was the signal that they said everything's going to be okay. And maybe, I mean, in the top of their mind, everything was okay, but they really didn't work on it. They didn't read the details. In other words, they were not a good stakeholder at that point, or we recall, or they were questionable. Because a stakeholder, the kind of activity we're looking for, is somebody that there were no doubts. They embraced the activity, the initiative that we were doing. So, and that is there's no really secrets to that, or there's no quick ways of accomplishing that. That is hard work. It means I mean, this is what I learned. I had to do my homework. It meant extra meetings or extra lunches or calling somebody back when I had to call 50 other people in the meantime. Or it was it's a lot of work to accomplish that. A second point, insight, I'd like to, this is, and again, I speak from my personal experience, and if some of you can benefit, is the focus on a business need or whatever the matter at hand. Because in other words, this happens sometimes when I'm with colleagues now, and they'll talk about, we'll put it in the newsletter, or we'll send an email out. Let's just have a big meeting, and big meeting meaning like 1,000 people or whatever, and it's that to me is like, I mean, I'm a little skeptical in the beginning at first, because I know for a fact that it may not work. It may work, but it may not work. And what that means is, and I mentioned some of the activities, is that I think we all, those of us who worked on the team, felt that you really had to use a combination, like a menu of different things. And it meant that we were going to stumble and fall on some of them. But the idea was to know how to pick ourselves back up and to then find out, well, how can we communicate? How can we get with, what kind of training can we provide for these folks? And the last thing is, and I've referred to this before, the skepticism. Because in one of our actual activities, with one of them was the reimbursement, employee reimbursement, was that we found out that people don't read and people don't listen. We didn't get cynical, but it just meant that we had to almost like guarantee that the message was not going to get out. We had rollout sessions explaining how that we created a new financial language for general ledger, which meant that even the HR things were going to have to change. And we had good presentations. Everybody's on their toes with questions. But then when it comes to implement things, it's like, well, wait a minute, you didn't tell me that. Well, did you read the email? Did you go to the rollout session? Do you remember where they talked about, oh, yeah, I see here. Oh, I see, yeah, it's even in capital letters and it's underlined. And I just missed it. I'm sorry, you know. So it's just, that's the frustrating part of it. But it was, that's where you realize you've got a job. You've got a job. The employee reimbursement system, and I think we've got some time here, just a few minutes. I have some samples. I don't know if I have enough for everybody in the room, but again, like Pat said, you could leave me a business card. But I did bring along, and it's a three pager on it was a communications plan that it's just very simple. It as a matter of fact, it goes into of all the processes I mentioned. This is a sample of one where just what our objectives were, how we're going to do it, and there are even some dates. So you notice it's dated, it's like almost 3 years old. It was in 1999, the fall of 99 when it really started. But it goes through step by step, and it shows several initiatives we did in doing that. And the feedback I've already mentioned that, the most meaningful one, and actually one of the most helpful ones was with the employee reimbursement, and that's where we learned that we wanted to really put the best foot forward on the first one we sent out, because we thought that, well, first impressions are lasting impressions. So this first one that we're going to do, we definitely want to do. So we did everything. We double-checked everything, and we everybody was trained and trained again and the third time, and then still we had the people that didn't read it or didn't. They happen to be on vacation that week or whatever. So that's when we thought that in earnest then, any initiative we had to do, we just could not assume anything. We had to almost assume the worst. We weren't pessimistic, we weren't cynical, but that is the kind of the approach we had. And so then summing up, I can just say that it was a happy experience. It certainly changed my life because I discovered the internal communications that basically you can't have a successful company these days without motivated employees who not only understand the business, they understand their competitors, but they're motivated about doing it. And so external reporting is very challenging dealing with the media and that, but it is extremely challenging to work with a company like with 100,000 employees, and make sure that they're informed. And this was for me, it was a positive experience. And Bell South, in it, not just changing, saving money, but it was not an easy change to go through. And we did go through the mourning process that Pat mentioned earlier, all the changes. But it did pay off. And then I just want to leave you with that last thought that people don't read, people don't listen, but they're smart, and just don't give up, because you will invariably, in a change process, there will be surprises. So,
yeah. I think we're almost at the closing time. What I suggest is Al and I will be here if you want to ask us some questions. I'm happy to. I'm around the rest of the conference. If you see what you want, pull me aside. I'd be happy to chat with you. If you did want that thing,